Welcome back to Behind the Scams. We have an episode that is definitely a must listen, not only for the teaching moments, but to learn how scams can go horribly wrong.
Yes, that's right. This is one of the more fascinating and dangerous scams we've covered here on Behind the Scams.
Yeah, I mean, today we are taking you on a really exhaustive, kind of a forensic deep dive into what criminologists actually refer to as the deadly retirement dream.
Right, the O'Malley case.
Exactly, the O'Malley case from, well, way back in 2002. But, you know, we aren't just looking at this as some isolated true crime history lesson.
No, definitely not.
Our mission today is to trace the psychological and the forensic footprint of this exact crime, you know, all the way to the modern global scam ledger of 2026.
Which is just wild to think about.
It really is. We're going to unpack how those very primal fears and deeply human dreams that were weaponized against victims over two decades ago, how they've mutated. We're looking at how physical chains in a Spanish cellar basically evolved into today's industrialized virtual kidnappings.
And digital arrests, yeah. I mean, the evolution of human deception is just staggering when you really lay it out on a timeline.
Totally.
Because, you know, at the core of every scam, before the money is moved or the trap is sprung, before any digital spoofing even starts, there is a fundamental human desire.
Right, there has to be something they want.
Exactly. And in the case of the O'Malleys, it was a desire for peace, you know, for a reward. A beautiful culmination of a life of just really hard work.
Yeah.
So to understand how scammers manipulate that, you really have to understand the specific victims. You have to know who Anthony and Linda O'Malley were.
Yeah, let's bring them into focus for you, the listener. Because Anthony O'Malley was 42 years old and Linda O'Malley was 55.
Right.
And they were just an ordinary, really hardworking British couple. Anthony was originally from Liverpool. And Linda was from Llangollen in North Wales.
And their origin story is incredibly grounded, actually.
Yeah, totally. They actually met and fell in love while they were working together at a motorway service station in Cheshire.
Wow.
Yeah. Think about the reality of that life. I mean, this wasn't a couple who was born into massive generational wealth or, you know, high finance. They were absolute grinders.
They really were.
Anthony eventually went on to make his living dealing in secondhand cars. And Linda ran a local shop.
Right.
So day in and day out, they were putting in the hours, they were dealing with the general public, managing the relentless stress of small business ownership in the UK.
And the weather.
Oh, exactly, the freezing rain.
Yeah.
And they had this shared driving aspiration. They just wanted to retire in the sun-drenched hills inland from Benidorm, Spain.
Yeah, the Costa Blanca.
Right. They were just looking for their own quiet slice of paradise.
And that background is actually the absolute key to their vulnerability here.
How so?
Well, when we look at the psychology of fraud, there's this concept known as optimism bias.
Optimism bias, okay.
Yeah. In a standard context, it's just a cognitive shortcut. It's where an individual genuinely believes they're, you know, less likely to experience a negative event than other people.
Like, oh, that won't happen to me.
Exactly. But optimism bias gets highly magnified, almost dangerously magnified, when someone feels they're on the absolute cusp of a well-earned reward.
Ah.
So put yourself in their shoes for a second. They had spent decades working in cold, damp environments. That Spanish villa wasn't just a regular real estate transaction. It was the emotional finish line of their entire lives.
Wow, yeah. The finish line.
And when victims are that close to the dream they've been visualizing for years and years, the brain's reward center starts firing so intensely that they just desperately want the dream to be real.
It's like a mirage in the desert.
That is a perfect way to put it. This intense emotional desire acts as a blinder. Hmm. It suppresses the brain's executive functioning, causing them to overlook, you know, subtle red flags that they might normally catch on a standard Tuesday morning business deal.
Well, see, I want to push back on that slightly, or at least explore the friction there a little bit.
Sure.
Because Anthony was a secondhand car dealer, and that is a profession built entirely on skepticism. I mean, he'd be used to kicking the tires, checking under the hood, negotiating hard. He'd spot a lemon from a mile away.
Yeah, absolutely.
He literally made his living not being taken advantage of. So how does a career negotiator, a guy whose radar for BS should be like fully finely tuned, how does he get blinded to that extreme degree?
That is the exact paradox that makes sophisticated fraud so terrifying.
Really?
Yes. Because the scammers didn't approach Anthony and Linda with some absurd cartoonish offer. They didn't say, you know, here's a 10-bedroom coastal mansion for £5,000.
Right, because if they had, Anthony's car dealer radar would have immediately flared up.
Exactly. Scammers, especially at this elevated level of criminality, they tailor their approach to the victim's experience level.
Wow. So they knew who they were dealing with.
When they interact with a knowledgeable target, they utilize a psychological technique called mirroring.
Mirroring. Okay, what does that look like in practice?
They match the victim's vocabulary, their business acumen, and their specific financial expectations. The fraudsters in this case offered a believable, modestly beautiful five-bedroom villa hidden among pine trees near the town of Alcoy.
Okay.
And it was priced to perfectly match the life savings the O'Malleys had diligently scraped together.
So it wasn't too good to be true. It was exactly good enough to be true.
Yes. As one of the behavioral psychologists in our source material noted, you might feel that because you are highly knowledgeable, it makes it harder to fool you. But in reality, the scammers just calibrate the bait. They match your specific intellectual and financial weight class.
That is so sinister. They make the trap look exactly like the deal you've been training your whole life to make.
Exactly.
So the bait was calibrated perfectly. Let's talk about the trap itself, which operated as a ghost listing.
Right.
The fraudsters were two men originally from Venezuela, Jorge Rial and his brother-in-law, Juan Antonio Velasquez. And the way they deployed this trap was brilliant in its simplicity, really. They placed a for sale advertisement for this villa in the Costa Blanca News.
Which is a huge detail.
It is. For the listener who doesn't know, the Costa Blanca News is an English language newspaper that caters specifically to British expats and tourists in Spain.
Right, it's very targeted.
It's the local paper you pick up at the pub or the cafe when you want to feel connected to the community. You trust it.
And the placement of that ad is a masterclass in what we call borrowed authority.
Borrowed authority, I like that term.
Yeah, by placing the ad in a trusted, localized publication that the expat community relies heavily upon, Rial and Velasquez hijacked the newspaper's inherent credibility.
Wow, so the newspaper did the heavy lifting for them.
Exactly. When the O'Malleys saw the ad in that specific paper, their brains subconsciously associated the listing with the safety and legitimacy of their own community.
But the devastating reality of the ghost listing was that Rial and Velasquez did not own the villa they were advertising at all.
No, not at all.
They had merely rented it. They were staging a physical environment. It's like a hermit crab.
A hermit crab.
Yeah, think of it like a hermit crab. The scammers are finding an empty, legitimate shell, in this case, a real rented house, and they are crawling inside it to where its credibility.
Oh, that's a great way to look at it.
They don't own the shell, but to the outside world, it looks like their home. It's an elaborate theater production where the property itself is nothing more than a giant prop.
The hermit crab analogy is spot on because it explains the physical mechanism of the deception. The victim walks into a physical space. The walls are real, the view is real, the keys are real.
You can touch the countertops.
Exactly. The sensory input confirms the dream. In a state of high emotional anticipation, the victim's prefrontal cortex, the logical part that says, hey, let's hire an independent Spanish solicitor to verify the title deed at the local registry, that part is completely overwhelmed by the sensory confirmation.
Right, because you're standing in your dream.
Furthermore, the scammers build a high-pressure rapport. They act as the welcoming committee. To demand legal documents in the middle of this carefully constructed honeymoon phase, it feels confrontational.
It feels rude.
Yes. It feels rude to the victim. The scammers manufacture a social reality where asking for basic proof feels like ruining the magic.
And tragically for Anthony and Linda, that emotional investment, that deep desire to not ruin the magic, was about to transition into a horrifying physical nightmare.
It really was.
That transition is where this story takes a really sharp turn from a standard real estate fraud into something entirely different.
Yeah.
And unspeakably dark.
Yeah.
Let's map out the timeline of the trap, the five-day siege that began in September of 2002.
The timeline is critical here because it shows the exact moment the psychology failed and the violence began.
Right. Let's walk through it.
So the lead-up to the nightmare really crystallizes on September 6, 2002. The O'Malleys were in Benidorm, staying in a hotel, enjoying the sun.
Just living the vacation life.
Yeah. They had been interacting with a British estate agent named Joanne Miles. Joanne was actually the last person to see the couple alive outside of their hotel on that day.
Oh, wow.
They told Joanne they might need a professional help because they were planning to buy a five-bedroom villa, and they actually arranged to meet her the very next day.
But of course, that meeting never happened.
No, it never did.
Because the financial setup was already in motion. The couple had gone to the trouble of opening a local Spanish savings bank account with Caja de Ahorros del Mediterráneo.
Right.
they had transferred 21,000 pounds from their British bank to use as the cash deposit for this dream home.
That's a massive amount of cash.
Huge. So the money was there, sitting in the Mediterranean, just waiting to be deployed. But then the trigger happens.
Yeah, the turning point.
And this is what the prosecutor suggested during the trial. The O'Malleys were kidnapped after they started getting cold feet about handing over that massive cash deposit directly to the men.
This is the inflection point. This is the exact moment the theater production falls apart. The O'Malleys, perhaps because Anthony's ingrained car business instincts finally overpowered that optimism bias we talked about, they hesitated.
He finally kicked the tire.
Exactly. They hesitated to hand over a literal bag of cash without the final paperwork. For Jorge Riel and Juan Antonio Velasquez, the fraud had suddenly hit a brick wall.
Yeah.
Now, consider the alternative behavior of a normal fraudster. When a purely financial scam fails, the scammers usually just vanish.
Right, they just ghost you.
They cut their losses, drop the fake email addresses, and look for the next susceptible victim. But Riel and Velasquez made the conscious, chilling decision to escalate.
Which is terrifying.
They used that rented villa, which was isolated and hidden among the dense pine trees near El Coy, as a literal prison.
The stage becomes a cell. I mean, picture this.
Yeah.
Anthony and Linda step inside that rented villa for what they thought was a final negotiation.
Or just a viewing to settle their nerves.
Right. They walk into the living room.
Yeah.
And the heavy wooden doors lock behind them. The welcoming committee drops the act. The smiles vanish. Guns are drawn. In an instant, the dream house becomes a jail.
The technicality and the cruelty of this crime are just terrifying. The couple was forced down into the villa's cellar. For 5 agonizing days, they were held captive in that dark underground space.
5 days.
5 days. The forensic reports and the court testimonies established the grim reality of those days. They were tightly bound, heavily chained, and gagged.
It's just horrific.
And in a detail that feels shockingly modern and honestly completely dystopian for the year 2002, the captors monitored the O'Malleys via a webcam.
A webcam. That detail stops me in my tracks every single time I read it.
It's unbelievable.
A webcam in 2002 was not a ubiquitous piece of technology like it is today. I mean, we all have them on our phones now.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, it required setup. It required intention.
You had to wire it up to a computer.
Exactly. Being watched by a cold, blinking camera lens while you're chained to a wall in a dark cellar.
Yeah.
The psychological torture of that is unimaginable. It strips away every ounce of humanity.
It really does.
And the physical torture was very real, too. The forensic report read out at the trial showed that Linda O'Malley had signs of having been brutally beaten during those 5 days.
Yeah.
But the scammers still wanted the money. The 21,000 pounds was sitting in a bank account, and they couldn't just wire it out themselves. They needed Anthony's physical presence to get it.
Right, they needed him to go to the teller.
So they orchestrated a coerced bank trip.
Yes, and this requires an incredibly high level of brazenness. They took Anthony O'Malley from the cellar out into the bright Spanish sunlight and forced him to walk into his local branch of the Caja de Ahorros del Mediterráneo.
I can't even imagine.
Put yourself in Anthony's mind in that moment. He is standing at a bank counter. The teller is right in front of him.
And he's probably sweating, terrified.
But he has a man standing right behind him, or waiting just outside the door, with a loaded pistol. More importantly, he knows his wife, Linda, is being held hostage back at the villa, chained in the dark.
Oh God, that leverage.
Under that unimaginable threat, Anthony was forced to withdraw 25,000 euros, which was roughly 17,000 pounds at the exchange rate of the time.
If you are listening to this, you might think, well, why didn't he slip the teller a note? Why didn't he blink SOS?
People always ask that.
Right. But that assumes a rational state of mind. When your spouse's life is hanging by a thread and a psychopathic killer is controlling the narrative, the fear paralyzes you.
Complete paralysis.
You follow the script because you are desperate to believe that if you just give them the money, they will let you both go.
Yeah, you just want to comply.
So he withdraws the money, he hands it over, and then we get to the grim, heartbreaking forensic specifics of their tragic deaths. Because the scammers had absolutely no intention of letting them go.
No, not at all.
After the withdrawal, Anthony was taken back to the villa. He was killed by suffocation. Police later found that a plastic bag had been placed tightly over his head.
It's so brutal.
He had severe neck injuries, indicating a struggle, and was found gagged with his hands and feet tightly bound. And Linda didn't survive either.
No.
She died of a massive heart attack. brought on by the immense, crushing stress and the physical beating she had endured during those 5 days of captivity in the cellar.
The utter callousness of the perpetrators didn't stop with the murders either.
How could it get worse?
It actually escalated into a grotesque display of greed. With Anthony and Linda dead in the cellar, Rael and Velasquez took the couple's credit cards and went on a brazen spending spree in the local towns.
Just going shopping.
Buying clothes, consumer goods, electronics. They also kept the couple's rental car, a Fiat Stilo, and were just driving it around the Costa Blanca as if absolutely nothing had happened.
Unbelievable.
They buried the bodies under a thin layer of cement right there in the cellar of the villa, packed up their stolen goods, and literally tried to move on to the next phase of their lives.
Here's where we need to examine the pathology of these specific offenders, because it breaks every rule we usually see here on the Deep Dive.
Right.
In the standard playbook of a scam, fraud is a crime of distance. It's almost a crime of cowardice.
Yes, very much so.
The scammer hides behind a fake email, a spoofed phone number, or a ghost listing. They avoid physical contact at all costs, because physical contact means physical evidence.
Exactly.
So what happens mechanically in the brain of a scammer when they decide to cross that massive line from wire fraud into physical violence, hostage taking, and ultimately murder?
Transitioning from fraud to violent physical abduction requires a profound lack of empathy, bordering on severe psychopathy.
Okay.
In a typical wire fraud, the scammer is heavily insulated from the victim's suffering. They don't see the tears, they don't hear the screams of panic. The victim is reduced to a data point, you know, a mere account balance on a screen.
Out of sight, out of mind.
But Rael and Velasquez brought their victims into a shared physical space. When the O'Malleys got cold feet, the fraudsters experienced a psychological phenomenon known as narcissistic injury.
Narcissistic injury? What does that mean?
They felt thwarted. They felt inherently entitled to that money, and the O'Malleys' hesitation was perceived as a personal insult to their control.
Wow, so it became about power?
The decision to use a gun in chains means they entirely stripped the O'Malleys of their personhood. They viewed them not as human beings with families and lives, but purely as physical obstacles separating them from their payout.
That is bone-chilling.
And that webcam monitoring we discussed earlier is particularly telling.
Oh, right. The webcam.
It allowed them to maintain a degree of emotional distance even while in the exact same building. They observed their victims like insects in a glass jar, completely desensitized to the horrific reality of the suffering they were inflicting.
It is the absolute darkest manifestation of human nature.
It really is.
So, with the scammers now outspending the victims' money on their credit cards, the O'Malleys have seemingly vanished from the face of the earth. To their friends and family back in the UK, the communication just goes completely dead.
Just radio silence.
How did a grieving family facing overwhelming bureaucratic apathy use a trail of digital breadcrumbs to finally bring the authorities to the door of these killers?
It's an incredible part of the story.
The investigation into this case is really a masterclass in persistence overcoming systemic failure.
The fight for justice in this case was incredibly fraught. It was absolutely not a smooth, immediate investigative response at all.
Not at all.
Initially, the Spanish police in Benidorm showed very little interest in the case.
And that is mind-boggling when you look at the fact.
Oh, completely.
They treated it as a standard missing persons case.
Yeah.
Or a voluntary disappearance.
Girl.
British detectives later openly complained to the press that the force in Benidorm had been, quote, less than interested in the early stages.
Which is just unacceptable.
And this was despite the glaring, undeniable evidence that the couple's credit cards were actively being used fraudulently in local shops weeks after they had missed their flight home.
It highlights a massive systemic vulnerability in cross-border crimes, especially in areas with high tourist turnover.
Right, because there's always people coming and going.
Exactly. Local jurisdictions often lack the resources, or frankly, the motivation, to aggressively investigate the disappearance of foreign nationals.
Because it's a headache.
Yes. The default assumption is often that the tourists simply moved on, extended their trip, or maybe returned home unannounced without telling their hotel.
So it's easier to just write it off.
It took profound, relentless intervention from the family to shatter that narrative. Anthony's brother, Bernard, and Linda's daughter from a previous marriage, Nicola Welch, they refused to accept the police apathy.
They wouldn't take no for an answer.
They didn't just make phone calls. They physically traveled to Benidorm.
Wow. kaboosh on the ground.
They went to the local press, they went to the British press, they raised massive public alarms, and they kept the pressure firmly on both the Guardia Civil in Spain and the British detectives back home.
That takes so much strength.
They essentially forced the authorities to look at the financial data that was screaming foul play.
But even with the family pushing relentlessly, the final break in the case didn't come from a brilliant piece of traditional detective work, right?
No, surprisingly not.
It didn't come from a fingerprint on a credit card slip. It came from the sheer unadulterated hubris of the killers themselves.
Jorge Rial essentially caught himself.
How does that even happen?
Well, 5 months after Hugh and Velasquez had murdered the O'Malleys, poured cement over their bodies, and spent their money, Rial decided the initial 25,000 euros and the credit card spree simply wasn't enough.
Are you kidding me?
He contacted the National Missing Persons Helpline in the UK.
Oh my God.
He posed as a private detective and claimed he had insider information that the couple was being held hostage on the Spanish coast by a dangerous gang.
A fake private detective.
He offered to mediate the release, but demanded a fee of £32,000 to organize the rescue.
I mean, the staggering arrogance of that. To call the helpline 5 months later knowing exactly where the body's buried.
It's psychotic.
And he didn't stop there. He escalated his own game. He actually spoke to an undercover British detective for a BBC One Real Story program, thinking he was talking to a desperate representative of the family.
The audio from that recorded call is chilling because you are hearing the voice of a psychopath enjoying his own cleverness.
Oh, absolutely.
Real, pretending to be this intermediary, was actively taunting the investigators. He told the undercover detective over the phone, quote, "They have moved these people 2 times, you know, from one place to another. They're confined to a room. These people, they can keep them there for a year if they want to."
Just flexing his power.
And then he added, in a moment of pure dark projection, quote, "And I ask, well, what are you going to do with those people, you know? Are you going to kill them? Or are you going to burn them?"
Oh my God, that is sick.
He was projecting his own violent actions, playing a psychological game of cat and mouse on national television.
But that game was his undoing.
Yeah, thankfully, yes.
Law enforcement finally had something tangible to track. They traced Real's emails and the digital footprint of his communications. They tracked the IP address back to a specific internet cafe in the city of Valencia.
Which is brilliant police work once they had the thread.
Yeah, and the staff at the cafe provided a physical description of the man using that computer, and it perfectly matched the man who'd been caught on grainy CCTV footage months earlier using Anthony O'Malley's stolen credit cards.
They had him.
They got his mobile phone number. The net finally closed.
The arrest itself was incredibly tense and speaks to the actual physical danger these men posed.
Tell me about it.
When the Spanish police swooped in to arrest Rial in Valencia as he was getting into a car, he didn't surrender peacefully.
Of course not.
He immediately reached for a bag he was carrying. Inside that bag was a fully loaded pistol and a fake police badge.
Wow.
Spanish detectives testified later that they firmly believed Rial would have opened fire and killed the arresting officers if he had been given even a fraction of a second more.
And when the authorities raided the cramped apartment in Valencia that Rial and Velasquez shared with their families, they uncovered what the police officially dubbed a fraud factory.
A fraud factory.
Yeah, it wasn't just the O'Malley's documents they found scattered around. The apartment was littered with fake police identification cards, high-end forgery tools, and sophisticated equipment for manufacturing false passports.
So this was a full-time job for them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This completely recontextualized the crime. This wasn't a one-off crime of passion or a robbery gone wrong. This was an industrialized criminal enterprise.
Ultimately, the pressure of the evidence broke Real. In an attempt to secure a deal or mitigate his punishment, he actually led the police back to the rented villa in Alcoy.
He gave it up.
He pointed them to the cellar, where investigators had to physically break through that thin layer of cement to recover the remains of Anthony and Linda.
God, how awful for the family.
Real, in typical narcissistic fashion, then tried to blame the actual killings entirely on his brother-in-law, Velasquez, claiming he was just a bystander to the violence.
Typical. Always pointing the finger.
But the Spanish court saw through the lies. The trial in Alicante resulted in a landmark ruling. The judges found them both guilty of kidnapping, murder, and fraud, handing down sentences totaling over 116 years.
Wow.
Jorge Rial received 62 years, and Juan Antonio Velasquez received 54 and a half years.
When the verdict came down, Bernard O'Malley stood outside the court and said, quote, "Today has been a long time coming. It has been a really difficult 4 years for everyone, and we are very pleased with the outcome."
Yeah.
And Linda's daughter, Nicola, captured the bittersweet reality of it.
Mm-hmm.
She said, "We have put them to rest, and today we have seen justice done, and that's the most we could have hoped for."
Heartbreaking.
But she also issued a vital warning to the public, saying her parents were astute, careful people, and that this danger of buying property abroad could happen to absolutely anybody.
Nicola's warning is deeply profound because it forces us to look beyond the isolated tragedy and examine the broader systemic issues at play here.
Right, because this didn't just happen in a vacuum.
Exactly. When we consult the source materials, particularly the Global Scam Ledger, we start to see how this localized real estate fraud in Spain connects to massive, recurring international financial vulnerabilities.
Okay, let's unpack that.
To understand why the O'Malleys were so exposed, we have to look at the concept of systemic friction and shadow environments.
Shadow environments.
Yes. A perfect parallel to this is the scissor hands or the blue dollar phenomenon, which is heavily documented in reports coming out of Argentina, like the Uplick report.
Let's build a bridge there.
Mm.
For the listener, what exactly is the blue dollar in Argentina, and how does the mechanics of that economy mirror the danger a British couple faced buying a house in Spain in 2002?
It's all about the environment in which fraud is allowed to thrive. The dollar blue in Argentina is an illegal parallel exchange rate.
Okay.
It exists because of extreme hyperinflation and strict government restrictions on accessing foreign currency, because the official rate is artificially controlled. A massive, untransparent dual economy has formed in the shadows.
Right, a black market.
Exactly. The Uplick report notes that this shadow economy routinely traps unsuspecting tourists. Mechanically, a traveler might go to get their phone fixed, be quoted a fair price in pesos based on the blue dollar rate they see on the street, but when they hand over their foreign credit card, the transaction is processed at the official government rate, effectively double charging them.
Wow, so they just get ripped off because they don't know the invisible rules.
It creates a chaotic environment where the rules are blurred, pricing transparency is zero, and jurisdictional accountability completely vanishes.
So it's really about operating in a space where the normal safety nets of your home country simply don't apply.
Exactly. Just as the blue dollar destabilizes the Argentine economy and creates a breeding ground for systemic scams against tourists, the unregulated cross-border nature of the O'Malleys' offshore property purchase created a shadow environment.
Ah, I see the connection now.
Think about the mechanics of international finance in 2002. Moving 21,000 pounds from a regulated UK bank to a regional Spanish savings bank, dealing with unregulated expat newspaper ads, navigating a foreign legal system in a second language,
mm-hmm.
All of this created massive systemic friction.
It's just a recipe for disaster.
It muddied the financial tracking. It created a jurisdictional gray area. The scammers operated with absolute impunity because they knew the British police couldn't easily peer into the Spanish banking system without months of red tape.
Bureaucracy.
And they knew the Spanish police wouldn't prioritize the financial discrepancies of missing British tourists. Rial and Velasquez exploited the systemic friction of international finance, much like the black market exploits the friction of the Argentine peso. The victim is caught in the middle, stripped of their native protections.
That makes total sense. But you know, I want to go back to Jorge Rial's behavior, though, because it still baffles me.
What part?
His hubris in calling the helpline. It reminds me of a gambler who is up big at the casino, but just fundamentally doesn't know when to leave the table.
That's a great analogy.
I mean, he had the 25,000 euros, he had the credit cards, he literally buried the evidence under solid cement. But he risks his freedom, his life, to come back 5 months later to extract another 32,000 pounds.
Yeah.
Mechanically, why do scammers so often return to the scene of the crime or try to extract a second ransom when they've already successfully gotten away with the initial theft?
It's a toxic combination of psychopathy and the concept of sunk cost within their own criminal infrastructure.
Okay, unpack that.
For a scammer running a fraud factory, the initial payout is rarely viewed as the end of the transaction. It is viewed merely as a down payment.
A down payment, wow.
They lack the impulse control to walk away because their entire psychological makeup is built on the thrill of manipulation and dominance over others. Real contacting the police wasn't just about needing more money. It was about proving he was intellectually superior to the authorities.
It was an ego trip.
Exactly. He wanted to play God with the family's emotions. Furthermore, In the scammer playbook, a victim who has paid once, or in this case, a grieving family desperate for answers, is viewed as a highly qualified lead.
That is so morbid, a qualified lead.
They believe the emotional desperation of the family makes them uniquely ripe for a secondary extraction. It is the ultimate manifestation of predatory greed. The empathy center of the brain is completely dark.
It's chilling to realize how calculated it all is. And having seen the tragic physical consequences of these tactics in 2002, we now have to turn the page.
You do.
We need to look at the global scam ledger to see how these exact same psychological manipulations, the optimism bias, the borrowed authority, the isolation, have been modernized, industrialized, and digitized for the year 2026.
Because the nightmare didn't end with Jorge Real.
Right. It just went online.
The transition from 2002 to 2026 is fundamentally a transition from physical cellars to digital prisons.
Digital prisons.
The underlying psychology remains identical, but the delivery mechanisms have become infinitely more scalable, untraceable, and insidious. We are no longer dealing with two guys in a rented villa. We are dealing with global industrialized networks.
Let's start with the direct descendant of the O'Malley siege, virtual kidnapping.
Yes.
The global scam ledger outlines a terrifying epidemic, specifically referencing the FBI's Operation Hotel Tango in Mexico.
A huge operation.
We are seeing a highly coordinated operation where scammers, operating entirely from inside Mexican prisons, are cold calling U.S. citizens.
Sitting in a jail cell making calls.
Exactly. They convince these innocent people that their loved ones are currently being held hostage. And they aren't just saying it, they are simulating it.
Yeah.
They use audio technology, three-way calling, and horrific fabricated screams in the background to simulate a physical kidnapping.
Mechanically, what they're doing is weaponizing the amygdala hijack.
Amygdala hijack, what is that?
The amygdala is the part of the brain that processes fear and threat. When a parent picks up the phone and hears what sounds like their child screaming for help, the amygdala instantly overrides the logical prefrontal cortex.
You just go into pure panic mode.
Exactly. The scammers bypass logic by inducing sheer biological terror. The victims genuinely believe their family member is chained in a cellar, just like the O'Malleys were. And the technology makes it so believable.
Because of the spoofing.
Right. They use voice over IP, or VOIP, to spoof the caller ID, making it look exactly like the call is coming from the loved one's actual cell phone. They scrape social media to learn the names of family members and specific details to make the threat credible.
And this isn't just a quick 5-minute extortion call either.
No, not at all.
Look at the specific case investigated by the Watsonville Police Department on the central coast of California.
That case is haunting. It proves you don't need a cellar anymore.
Exactly. In the Watsonville case, a family was manipulated into a 30-hour siege inside a hotel room.
30.
They were completely cooped up, terrified, following the scammer's relentless orders over the phone for over a day. They believed they were in imminent physical danger if they hung up or contacted the real police.
And the craziest part, the scammers never laid a single finger on them.
Not once.
They were hundreds of miles away, sitting in a foreign prison cell. The control was entirely psychological. The prison walls were built entirely out of the victim's own fear.
Which perfectly mirrors another terrifying trend we are seeing globally, what we call the digital arrest playbook.
Right.
The source materials detail a horrifying case from Singapore involving a 19-year-old Chinese university student named Bai. This happened in April 2022.
Oh, the Bai case.
Yeah. Scammers posing as Chinese authorities contacted Bai and convinced him he was deeply implicated in a transnational money laundering ring. They manipulated him to such a degree that he staged his own kidnapping.
The Bai case represents a profound, almost unbelievable evolution of the O'Malley trap. Just as Anthony and Linda were hidden away in a physical villa among the pine trees by armed men, Bai was manipulated into isolating himself.
Voluntarily.
He was instructed to hide in a safe house in the Woodlands area of Singapore. The duration of the ordeal is eerily exactly the same as the O'Malley's, 5 days of complete isolation.
That parallel is wild.
But Bai wasn't locked in by heavy chains or a man with a gun. He was locked in by his own fear of the authorities. The scammers convinced him that if he didn't cooperate, his family in China would be ruined.
And it gets weirder.
It does. In a bizarre twist that shows the multi-layered nature of these scams, another victim, a woman named Ivy, who was also being controlled by the same syndicate, was instructed to meet him at East Coast Park.
Wait, two victims controlled by the same people?
Yes. She brought fake blood makeup, applied it to Bai, and recorded ransom videos. Bai then sent those terrifying videos of himself to his own mother in China.
and it worked. His parents transferred 50,000 RMB to the scammers, thinking their son was facing physical mutilation by a cartel.
The isolation is identical to 2002.
But the weapon is just a smartphone instead of a pistol. The captor is inside your head.
Precisely. The scammer no longer needs to risk their own physical freedom by being in the same room as the victim. And this evolution extends back to the core vulnerability that doomed the O'Malleys in the first place. The dream of international real estate and the search for the perfect rental.
Oh, absolutely.
Protecting the modern retirement dream has become an absolute minefield. The Ledger documents modern rental scams that are playing out right now in Spain and across Europe that make the old ghost listings look like child's play.
Right, there's the highly publicized case of the American family relocating to Madrid.
That one was everywhere.
There were savvy, digitally native people documenting their travels to 70,000 followers on Instagram. They found what looked like the perfect short-term rental on the popular Spanish real estate platform Idealista. But then the communication moved off the platform onto WhatsApp.
Which is the modern equivalent of leaving the safety of the bank to do a deal in an alleyway.
I love that analogy.
Moving off platform strips away all the buyer protections built into the app.
Exactly. But the scammer was so convincing. The scammer sent a legally binding looking contract complete with authentic looking NIE numbers, which are the official Spanish identification numbers for foreigners.
They had all the right props.
They sent passport scans.
Yeah.
It all looked totally legitimate and airtight. The family wired the deposit and the owner instantly vanished. The family arrived in Madrid with all their luggage and were left scrambling for housing just weeks before moving. And we see similar reports of Irish renters being tricked into transferring funds to untraceable offshore accounts in Malta.
So this brings us to a critical, actionable debate for you, the listener. The landscape is absolutely saturated with these highly evolved ghost listings.
It really is.
How do you safely verify international real estate today without putting your life savings or, as we've seen, your actual life at extreme risk?
Okay, I have strong feelings on this. My perspective, my golden rule has to be, always view the property in person. Never ever wire money off platform.
Bet.
If you find a place on Idealista, Airbnb, or Vrbo, you keep every single message and every single penny of payment strictly inside that app's walled garden. Do not let them transition you to WhatsApp.
Right.
Do not do a direct bank transfer, no matter what discount they offer. And if you are buying a property outright, like the O'Malleys were, you must hire verified independent legal representation in the destination country.
Yeah.
Don't use the lawyer the seller recommends. Find your own solicitor who has a fiduciary duty to protect you.
While your advice on legal representation is foundational, I have to strongly push back on the idea that an in-person viewing guarantees your safety in 2026.
Really? Why?
The scammers have already adapted to that advice. We are currently seeing epidemic levels of cases where scammers use legitimate short-term Airbnb rentals to host mass fraudulent viewings.
Wait, how does that even work?
Mechanically, here's how they do it. The scammer rents a nice apartment for the weekend on Airbnb. They get the physical keys. They then list that same apartment for long-term rent on a local classified site at a very attractive price.
Oh.
They bring in dozens of prospective tenants over the weekend, show them around the physical space, open the cabinets, let them test the water pressure, hand them the keys to hold, and collect thousands of euros in first and last month deposits via digital bank transfers on the spot.
Because they're physically there.
They appear 100% legitimate because they are physically standing in the living room with you. By Monday, the real Airbnb owner returns, the scammer is gone, and 20 different people show up with moving boxes trying to unlock the exact same door.
Wait, I struggle to believe that is sustainable for a scammer. If I am physically holding the keys to the apartment and standing inside it, how can the platform or the police not hold the person who listed it accountable?
You'd think so.
There has to be a paper trail. They book the Airbnb, they use a bank account to receive my deposit.
That assumes they are using their own identity.
Oh.
The entire operation is built on layers of stolen credentials. The Airbnb was booked using a stolen credit card and a hacked profile. The bank account receiving your deposit is a mule account.
A mule account?
An account opened by a vulnerable person who is paid a small fee to let the syndicate route money through it before it's instantly converted to cryptocurrency and sent overseas.
So it's untraceable.
The physical presence in the apartment means absolutely nothing because the person standing in front of you is a ghost operating behind stolen faces.
That is terrifying.
Yeah.
It entirely negates the human instinct to trust what we can physically see and touch.
It does. The only true impenetrable defense is rigorous, independent, bureaucratic verification. You must verify the land registry deeds to ensure the person standing in the room actually legally owns the property.
Which takes time.
Yes. Huh. Furthermore, you have to actively train yourself, biologically, to refuse high-pressure manufactured scarcity tactics.
Like act now or lose it.
Right. If the landlord says, you have to wire the deposit right now because five other people want it and I have another viewing in 10 minutes, you have to be willing to walk away.
Just walk away.
You must understand that offshore deals, even seemingly simple rentals, carry extreme risk because you are operating outside your native legal, banking, and cultural protections.
It is a profoundly terrifying landscape when you lay it out like that. We've gone from physical traps in the Spanish Hills to psychological prisons in our own homes.
We really have.
We've gone from fake newspaper ads in expat communities to the sophisticated, multi-layered staging of Airbnbs using stolen identities. It proves that while the technology changes at lightning speed, the human vulnerabilities, our hopes, our fears, our optimism bias remain exactly the same.
Which leaves us with a final provocative thought to ponder as we close this deep dive.
Let's hear it.
Consider the evolution of control. In 2002, it took a physical cellar, heavy iron chains, and a real loaded gun to isolate Anthony and Linda O'Malley from the world. It required the physical risk of the captor.
Right, they had to be there.
Today, scammers don't need any of that. They use spoofed caller IDs, AI-manipulated audio, and our own deepest psychological fears to make us isolate ourselves.
We do the work for them.
We lock our own doors. We hide in our own hotel rooms. We willingly stage our own kidnappings and send the ransom notes ourselves. If the prison is no longer a concrete cellar in Spain, but is now constructed entirely within our own minds, how do we ever truly know when we are safe?
Thanks for listening to Behind the Scams, and remember to stay skeptical and stay safe out there. Bye for now.